welcome to the May 30th edition of the In the Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with
VR
and
MCB.
Master Control Ben is in the house. Master Control Ben is actually related to JP, which is one of the characters we had on the show here back in the day. Checked out in the 2001-2002 shows.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good guy.
Good guy. All right. Okay, lots to talk about as usual. And VR and MCB are actually sharing a mic here, so we are going to have to deal with that.
Yeah, we get a little pause because we have to reach for the mic.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We can handle
it. Get your hand off the mic. All right. And now, look at that. You even got a foot on the mic there, VR.
I'm a control freak. Thank you very much.
Oh, man. Well, that's not good. Okay.
VR does not play well with others.
All right. Now, he might want to spontaneously grab that mic. So, keep that hand at least 2 feet away from it at all times.
I have been, but you know what? We're having a conversation here, and every time I put it back, I'm allowing him the opportunity to say something.
If you see him make the smallest gesture for that mic, you release it right away.
That I've already done.
Okay. Okay. All right. We can do a show, but we cannot do certain things, so we're trying to do as much as we can at one point in time. All right. Well, some of the news that's out there. This is kind of an interesting story. It's a very long article that explains a lot of different backgrounds and stuff like that. But basically, there's a guy named Chuck Clark, and he ran into an underground device around Area 51 in the public areas. Now, what he found out that this device does is basically, if you get next to it, it senses that you're next to that device, and it's in a grid pattern all around certain areas on the edge of Area 51, and that is a wireless device in sort of like a suitcase with a little antenna that sticks up out of the ground in maybe a little grassy area where it's kind of hard to see. I guess originally they were really easy to see, and then they came out and dug them up and made them a little harder. And it seems to alert officials that you are walking towards the border of where you shouldn't be at.
Well, that makes sense from everything I've seen and heard. That, you know, like every time there's a film crew that is even getting close to Area 51, just immediately there's like three vehicles that just show up magically.
Yeah, too bad they don't have that on the border. But yeah,
wouldn't that make, that would definitely curb this whole immigration.
Yeah. So yeah, they have that, and basically he got harassed by the secret agents out there for digging up the device. He said he put the device back every time that he dug it up. I think he only dug it up once. Either way, he didn't tamper with the device. He just wanted to take a look at it, put it back in its resting place, but there was a device stolen, or so said. And some guy showed up at his door and all that goodness. So, but he didn't disappear. He's okay. And basically, he just doesn't want to talk about that kind of stuff anymore, and he's just staying away from him. Speaking about Chuck Clark here, and,
Yeah, so he's not speaking about it, but, we're perpetuating it for you there, Chuck.
Yeah, so Chuck, sorry, word's been spread. Actually, it was written by Kevin Paulson, which is a famous ex-hacker, who actually does a lot of the news reporting over at securityfocus.com. All right.
That'd be kind of neat to see, to know what kind of, energy that they were using to, sense movement and weight. If it was actually just like a magnetometer, or if it was if it was sensing vibration of the ground, or it actually had microwave field.
It seemed to be something that disrupted some electrical field.
Yeah, that's still kind of different. Well, it could be like in between the two. That'd be strange, because then it would also have to ignore all the plant life, coyotes, that sort of thing. There'd be a lot of false positives.
Yeah. Well, I mean, only if it worked in a way where that happened.
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking like the actual vibration of the ground would probably be the safest thing. Because everything they're looking for is over 100 pounds. Like a person is usually over 100 pounds and a vehicle's over 100 pounds.
What do you think, though, about the antenna, though? The antenna wouldn't do that.
Well, that would just be to transmit it.
Transmit. Okay.
That's all it would need to be.
Could be.
So it's like nothing special. It's just little. Geologists have been using that for decades.
Yeah. All right. You know, did you see the day after tomorrow?
No, I didn't. I want to, though, because that's just... It's going to be very prophetic here very soon.
Well, it's also very, very political movie. Like, it seems like it was written by the Democrats.
Right on. We'll see here, like, we're... In the patterns that we've figured out for, like, solar flare cycles, we're overdue. We're overdue for the polar... The magnetic field of the Earth to switch, you know, and by the Mayans, we're up to have, you know, our farm animals turn on us too.
Well, I saw the movie with Master Control, Ben. What do you think of the movie?
Was it a decent movie? Pretty cool.
Yeah, I liked it until it just kind of like they had a guy in there that looked like, Dick Cheney as the vice president, and then they had all these. You know, very obvious, political statement saying, like, this is how something is or something like that. Not for global warming, but for about, like, not using alternative fuels and stuff like that. It kind of, like, made it seem like if you're bought an SUV and you watch that movie, like, you know, they're, like, tearing you to shreds during the whole movie.
This is what you're going to do to the planet driving your SUV.
Yeah, I hope you're happy driving home because you're going to, like, you know... freeze most of Northern America here pretty shortly. Like, I think SUVs suck, but, you know. I just didn't kind of like to have that feeling in the movie. I don't own an SUV. I own a Jap car. But, you know. And then, they did have something that was kind of funny, though, that I really liked. They had this part where, since Northern America was going to freeze over, and that's the only detail I'll give you about the movie, well, you'll hear this funny party too. All right, tune out for the next 1 minute if you don't want to hear about it. They send everybody towards Mexico to go down there because up north it was going to get cold and freeze. So at first, Mexico was not allowing U.S. citizens to enter the country, and then they said, Mexican government has now allowed the citizens to enter the country. After we have forgiven them of all their debt.
Oh, yeah, we got to pay them off.
Yeah. So
that's beautiful.
But is it okay if we accrue some debt over there as well? And then maybe if they need to come back out north, we'll pull the same deal off?
Yeah, I would think that would be, you know, that would be reasonable and fair and reciprocal.
Yeah, so it was pretty funny. Everyone was laughing their ass off in the theater.
Oh, I could see that.
All right. Moving on, Snort out there is actually an intrusion detection system based on open source software. And basically, the creator of the open source network-based intrusion detection system says the software is up for overhaul. The inability of many to tune an IDS, which is intrusion detection system, minimizing the number of false alarms triggered by the monitoring devices has been a major drawback for the widespread acceptance of the technology. And that's actually the maker saying that. The next generation of Snort will include passive discovery features, Rose said, which will automatically tweak the package's settings. IDS is not working as well as had been hoped or as well as has been hyped, he said. People have been saying IDS can be used to secure your network, but that's not the role of an IDS. Now the chief technology officer of U.S.-based SourceFire, which sells Snort-based intrusion detection systems, Rose says auto-discovery features could also be used to apply specific detection policies to particular devices on the network. If the new software detects an Apache server running on Linux, it will only look for attacks relevant to that configuration instead of monitoring the device for an attack that would affect a Cisco router or a Windows server. So just getting more more intelligent intrusion detection system.
Yeah, it just sounds like fine-tuning it, honing it.
And in order to have those types of features, it sounds like it's kind of a... and to implement it properly, it's going to be kind of rewritten. And
well, especially if it's able to, like, essentially tweak itself to, you know, to eliminate more false positives.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really what it's all about, because if you start watching too many false positives, it's just kind of like you get sick of looking at it, and it's kind of like yelling wolf too many times. And
yeah, you tend to ignore it.
Yep. Also, Now, it's great when we talk about things in the past and they kind of come together and evolve into something that's new. We've talked about quantum cryptography. We've talked about the Echelon system, which is the Big Brother system that watches over you, your family, and your dogs while you're sleeping in bed. But basically, the UE, the European Union, seeks quantum cryptography in response to Echelon. I don't know if that's the real reason, but it's also a good idea to try to be as secure and keep your information as, you know, defined on who you would like to have it viewed as much as possible. Basically, the European Union is to invest 11 million euros, which is $13 million in our money, over the next 4 years to develop a secure communication system based on quantum cryptography using physical laws governing the universe on the smallest scale to create and distribute unbreakable encryption keys, project coordinator said Monday, which is back in mid-May. The now, with quantum cryptography, we've talked about it before, which basically, if you send a signal down a, let's just say, a fiber pipe, and it's sent by using light, and it's encrypted with quantum cryptography, the way it works on the other end, and it really takes a lot of explanation to really explain this to a T, but really, the way it is that if you, let's say, tap the line or modify any sort of means, then its original prescribed transmission, if you modify it, view it, tap into it, anything like that, you actually have changed the physical aspect of the data that's gone through there. And with quantum physics, it's basically everything that can be applied to an object, if applied, has therefore changed its structure. So using quantum cryptography, you could basically find out if something has been broken to or viewed in a way that's not supposed to be viewed, that has now changed its structure and can be, that information can be retrieved.
Well, it at least is detected that it's been viewed by another.
Yeah.
Because once it's been viewed, it's different and then cannot be viewed again. Usually, how we have been talked about it, because the key is, you know, it's got to be so precise that once it's been viewed, it can't be viewed again, as, except by, you know, a new key, because every time you view it, you've changed it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you can if it changes the original data. It may or may not. I think you could view it again.
What was sent? Like, it would have to be sent once again. It'd be like, you know what, that was viewed. Well, we would have to, you know, then go by a different route in order to transmit that information. And then if it wasn't viewed again, then I could see it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I've never really thought about if you can actually view it again on the other end. I'm not sure about that. But
you'd have to, you know, do like a secondary key for after it was viewed.
I think once it's sent across, I think what I'm understanding is you can view it at the other end. But it also comes across saying that something has changed, and that therefore shows that the integrity of the message is now broken.
Well, I can see that, but the crucial thing in like how I interpret that, because it was an unbreakable system, so the only way it could really be unbreakable is if it could only be undone once. If it was, and then how do you really, if it's been viewed, and then it's sent down the, you know, and then it's sent down the way.
Oh, okay, if it's not viewed the way it's supposed to be viewed, then yeah, the message is scrambled and kind of
it's gone. It's completely.
That's
incorrect.
Probably correct. If successful, the project will produce a cryptographer's holy grail, absolutely unbreakable code, and thwart the eavesdropping efforts of espionage systems such as Echelon, which intercepts electronic messages on behalf of the intelligence services of the U.S., Britain, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. And also, you know, they have a device out here that does send quantum encryption back and forth. And I've seen the device, not physically, but I've seen it, you know, in image. And it's been used, and I think their limit is up to 100 feet that they can do it before it should become so unstable and they can't even use it.
Yeah, because it's constantly being bombarded by neutrons and, you know, completely other subatomic particles and radiation and microwaves and radio waves and gamma rays, X-rays, and all the other rays.
Yeah, and a guy named Ray. But the aim is to produce a communication system that cannot be intercepted by anyone, and that includes Echelon, says Sergio Kovo. a professor with the electronics department of Milan Polytechnic, one of the project coordinators. The major improvements, basically there's a lot of things that need to happen in innovations before they can actually make this workable. Major improvements would be in geographic range and speed of data transmission before the system could be actually commercially viable to even do that. So,
well,
if you want to send something very private to, you know, your neighbor, you could do that. But
yeah, but then the government's not going to allow it to be a commercial product because they won't be able to break it.
Well, they mean commercially, like, you know, industrial grade. They probably use the wrong word.
Yeah, and actually, it would be only for government and Big Brother use.
Yeah. Aren't they the same? Isn't that supposed to be the same?
Oh, no, I don't believe that they're actually one and the same.
Okay. Well, I know that. I was just kind of messing with you. There's a lot of Big Brother going on all over the place.
Now there's a new reality series, Big Brother 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, actually, it's been big in Europe for a while.
Wow. See, I don't have Jack for TV. That's the master control, Ben, taking care of all the controls that he needs to be taken care of out there in the world today. All right. The next story here that we're going to move on to is that basically people are trying to find cheap ways.
Holy Grail.
Cheap ways. Well, yeah, that too. Cheap ways to get to
Mars.
Is Master Control Ben taking off?
Why, yes he is.
Or is he just doing the phone?
No, I think he was actually leaving.
Okay, well, everyone say goodbye to Master Control Ben.
Bye, Master Control Ben.
He just came by to say hello and everything.
He's been gone.
Oh, you know what? I haven't even talked about what's happened to Slipknot. I haven't even talked about that.
Oh, my.
Yeah, everyone's going to hear the show.
Oh, I know. This is such a great travesty.
Yeah, okay, this is crap. Okay, this story can wait. Okay, so here's what happens, all right? You've heard Duel talk about Quest over at Old School Freak, but I've got a Quest story for you. Okay, here it goes. I don't remember the date. You know what? I'm going to look at the date here. It's going to pop this up. It wasn't then. It was...
It was even further back than that.
Yeah, it was the 20th of May. The 20th of May, I find out in the middle of the night, I'm surfing, right? I'm on the internet. I'm doing my thing. I'm a cyber junkie. I'm riding the data. But...
You cyberine.
Yeah. And it stops. No more internet. That's it. Gone. Capiche. Kaput.
And you just bailed on the wave of the cyber wave.
Yeah.
Something around it.
Yeah. We're trying to get all big here.
All dramatic.
Yeah. Actually, as I speak right now, the internet is down. Okay. So here's what happens. Found out, because I don't pay the bill here all the time. Found out there was a problem with the bill. Okay, we didn't know it was that much of a problem to where it was going to be disconnected, but I guess it was. The phone stayed on, internet gone. Take the phone away. I don't care about the phone.
Yeah, who cares about the phone?
I got a cell phone, man. So internet gone, right? So I call up. So there's a problem with your bill. Okay, blah, 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 blah. Office opens up in the morning. Wake up in the morning, pay the bill. Boom, paid, done. Get my crap online now, right away. Oh, sir, it's going to take till June 1st. Okay. Well,
that's 11 days.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
11 days to go without internet service?
Oh, well, here's how I'll tell you how I improvise, which isn't even very much funner. Okay, so it's out, right? And they're like, well, sir, and this is a Thursday. I don't know, Friday morning. We'll get it up by Wednesday. We'll expedite it. We'll do what we got to do to get you up. We love you. You're our Quest customer. Okay, so...
Yeah, whatever.
Some detail here. I was in an older modem and on an older DSL technology, CAP technology. And when they pulled me off of that, they ripped me out of the old board and said, you need a new modem. I don't mind a new modem because it includes wireless on it and everything. Kind of cool. So, okay, fine.
So they actually did that on purpose to fry your old modem so you would also have to upgrade at the same time.
I had a conspiracy theory. I expressed it to some guy, so they can't really see that.
Well,
I don't know either way. But putting that aside, though, there's still a bunch of crap that happened. So Wednesday, I'm supposed to be getting the device that's going to get me on the internet, right? No. I did not get that device whatsoever. He said that he would expedite it. It should be getting to my house Wednesday, and then I would be able to get on the internet that day. Call him up, get the hookup, yada, yada, yada. Nope, didn't happen. I called Wednesday, okay, since I didn't get the device. They said, well, we'll just overnight it to you. You'll get it Friday, and then we'll get you on the internet. No. No overnight. I mean, I got, like, you know, internal tracking numbers and all this crap. Didn't mean a thing, because none of that was written down. It was total BS told to me.
They just made up numbers and gave it to you?
I don't know. I didn't give them the numbers back, because I asked, is there any notes? And they're like, no. So, anyways, I then say, screw it, okay? Well, even before that, I had to get on the internet. Well, what did I do? I was down at Kinko's and picked up an AOL 9.0 optimized CD.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, how low Slip is sunk.
Slip had to use free AOL dial-up for 45 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
I was surfing, man, at a maximum of 43 kilobits per second.
Oh.
Yes, but...
That's like having both legs tied together.
I had to stay in Windows because... It runs in Windows. So did that. I was on the internet. Could not do anything. My site, Slipnet, runs out of my house. Off my static IPs, off my internet. What does that mean? Kaput, gone, no site. Bad backup plan, right? Okay. So it happens. It rarely happens. It happened once out of the whole time the site's been up. Okay. So okay. Shame on me, but it happened once. Okay, so in the meantime, Slip goes out to his host, and then he creates a new place for slipnet.org over at this host. So he does that, and can't upload any files, because my connection's just too damn slow. So I just waited till June 1st came around, and got on the internet, and it was 5 o'clock. I got my modem, hooked it up. No internet. Called them at 5 o'clock. Called Quest. Quest said, we'll have you up in a minute. We'll call you back when we can get it up. It's not done yet. Okay. So I get
it. It's 5 o'clock. You're leaving. You're out of there. You'll call me tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, no, they're 24 hours, these guys.
Oh, okay.
Not the office where you make payments. So anyways, I get a call back at around 7:30 or whatever saying that it's back up. And I'm telling them, look, you need to restore my old username so I can get my old email address. And you need to restore my block static IPs. So, okay, we're going to work on that. That's fine. So, Slip goes and he gets the slipnet.org up and copies up to his server. Still got to copy the forums up there. Got to work on that. But all the shows are up there. And got to put this show up there still. And then, so that's back up. Okay, we fixed that problem. Well, how long did that last? Okay. Well, how are we doing the May 30th show, you may wonder. Well, we're doing it a little late, actually.
Exactly.
Because we knew the internet was going to be down. But now it's June 1st, okay, and I have the internet up. Well, at 5:30 in the morning, June 2nd, it's out. It's gone. No more. Once again, back to the dial-up. But I don't have a dial tone this time, so I can't even use dial-up. So I call
So your internet went back down.
And I lost dial tone.
And you lost your dial tone. But the whole time that your internet was down, your dial tone was okay.
Before, yeah.
Okay.
Now we lost dial tone, too.
Now they're just messing with you.
Yeah. So I call up the repair office, get a guy to come out. He comes out. By the time he comes out, dial tone's back. Internet still down. He goes, well, we're going to have to bring a DSL guy out here tomorrow. So, okay. So I'm still waiting.
Hopefully the DSL guy also knows how to fix the phone lines, too.
Yeah.
Because they'll be both down tomorrow.
Yeah. So right now, internet down, dial tone back, dial up, yay. So, yeah, that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, it sounds like you just need to do a whole page box.
Yeah.
Just blow the whole thing up. And
You mean a blotto box? The blotto box is when you attach, like, a big generator.
I thought that was a beige box.
No.
I've seen it referred to as a beige box.
The blotto box.
Okay.
It's the B that's messing you up there. So, yeah. So, anyways, yeah, bunch of crap. So, that's what happened to Slipnet. And Slip has put some redundancy in there and put that back up. and got it up. Got to get the forums up there, though, and got to get this show up. So hopefully I'll have the internet up tomorrow, and I'll get this show up, and I apologize for that. Okay, we probably lost all of our listeners during that downtime. Oh, they're gone.
Yeah. We'll have to build back up from 3 once again.
Yeah, shoot. We'll get to 5 shortly. Okay, well, this is what I was talking about before. Basically a cheap way to get to space. Not space, near space. And what they're developing here, and I believe it was a private company. JP Aerospace Hangar. It's a V-shaped airship bigger than the size of a baseball diamond is due to rise from the West Texas desert to an altitude of 100,000 feet to basically navigate by remote control, linger above the clouds, and drift back to Earth. For the U.S. Air Force, okay, it is not a private company, the feat will demonstrate the feasibility of a new kind of semi-autonomous craft that could hover in near space to do reconnaissance and relay battlefield communications. The eye in the sky, folks.
Ooh, yeah.
Basically, it's roughly...
But you know really why, when we already have satellites that can, like, take a picture of what you're reading?
Well, maybe this covers the blackout areas.
Oh, that's true, over battlefields. And so what if it gets shot down, kind of thing?
Well, it's really high up there.
Still can be shot down.
It's really high up there.
Still can be shot down.
Well, if they even have that ability, you know,
well,
shoot down the rocket that's going up there. Because it's not going to be a gunshot.
No, it'll be like a rocket.
Yeah.
Still be shot down, though.
You don't believe that we could shoot down the projectiles that are going on its way to it?
Yeah, they've been working on Star Wars for the last 20 years.
I saw a video of a 747 with a tip at the end of it, which is basically a mirror that can focus where a laser beam shoots, and they have tested it, and they have shot down ballistic missiles. We talked about it, I think, on one.
Yeah, they were successful once, they missed another one, or even twice, and they missed another one. That's two-thirds accuracy. Now, they've been working... Do you want to have two-thirds accuracy when 50 nuclear warheads are on their way here?
Well, the Patriot system worked really well to the Scuds that were being fired over to Kuwait.
Yeah, they still missed quite a few, though.
But they got a lot.
Yeah, they got a lot.
You've got.
But do you want to have one?
I
want
to have as much as I can. What I'm saying is...
Do you want to have 100% or when you're dealing with, like, nuclear stuff? Because that's really what they're pushing for.
Well,
this is all the in-between stuff. They're really pushing for
Star Wars. Not much 100% in anything in this world, my man. And we both know that.
Well, you need to be when you're looking at nuclear weapons.
Okay. How about we just offer, what's his name over in North Korea, I don't know. He's a really weird guy. He likes to watch cartoons.
I like to watch cartoons.
Yeah, you're a really weird guy. No, I like to watch cartoons, too. All right, well, moving right along.
Yeah, but you like those strange cartoons, man.
Oh, yeah, some hentai porn action, huh? No, I'm just joking. Those are really weird. Those are like messing with little... I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's really
weird.
The
whole idea of it is kind of disturbing.
Yeah, so I'm moving on. Okay, well, here's another story that's kind of interesting. Google may sue Google.
Right on.
Yeah, okay. Google. See how that's spelled? It's a Google.
Yeah, that it is.
That's, you know.
It's just spelled differently.
Yeah, well, you know the number of the Google.
Googleplex. You know, Google Plex.
Google's IPO is coming. The company is on the verge of being sued by a family of a man who invented the word Google to describe a very big number. Professor Edward Kasner came up with the word Google apparently at the suggestion of his 9-year-old nephew. He used the term in the 1940s in his book Mathematicians and the Imagination. For the record, a Google is 10 raised to the 100th power, or the number 1 followed by 100 zeros. In 1955, he died, and much later a search engine called Google was born. I doubt that there was any relation. Maybe there was.
Yeah, actually, well, their program thing... Very much, it could have been influenced earlier in his life.
His relatives claim that Kasner must be spinning in his grave. They believe Google has gained financially at their expense and may want to become IPO insiders to put his soul to rest. Wow, adding a lot of stuff there. Hatch from the Baltimore Sun interviewed Kasner's great-niece, Perry Flesher, who is coincidentally a compensation specialist for a Silicon Valley firm.
Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah. She admitted that she has was only 4 when Kasner died, could only just remember him barely. But
she's going to cha-ching cash in.
Oh, yeah. She said that although Google has brought attention to the name, it has not brought attention to... You know, it's supposed to be brought, and they spelled bought in this article. They spelled it wrong.
Well, that's okay. Spell check is not perfect.
Yep. Neither is ballistic missile takedown.
good little stick there.
brought attention to Kasner's work. Google was not using the concepts, but just capitalizing on the name.
But one nuclear weapon is way too much.
Doesn't fit in my cereal bowl.
That's right.
And who is there? But just capitalizing on the name, she said, even though the name's spelled differently, you know.
Well, they mean completely different things. One was a number, the other is a search engine.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. What they're really looking for, well, I don't know what they're really looking for, but what they said is they don't want cash. They just want the opportunity to operate as insiders for the IPO. They want to get on the initial IPO. They want to be on the initial buy. Okay? But Google's kind of like saying, nah, and not paying any attention to them, so they might... They're thinking that they might sue. They might. So, either way, they want, you know, if they don't get what they want.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's, you know, legal tactics anymore. Well, if you don't get what you want, threaten to sue.
Yeah.
Now you just still don't get what you want, sue.
And if you don't want you to get what you want,
counter sue.
Just
sue again.
Yeah, so, you know, they have the right to do that. And maybe there's some thing, but I don't know. But it is kind of weird. If they walk away with $10 million, I'll be like, what? So, I don't know. Okay. This article here is insane. Insane.
In the membrane.
Don't you know I'm loco? All right. Basically, feed the worms who write worms to the worms.
So, feed worms and write worms to the worms. Let me see if I'm getting this.
Who write worms are internet worms. Remember that. So feed the worms.
Uh-huh.
Who write basically the internet worms.
Oh.
To the worms.
Oh, kill them.
The economic logic of executing computer hackers.
Right.
This is so ridiculous, dude. He actually lays out a very, very large argument.
Well, it's true because internet, you know, people who write worms and those sorts of things, cost the economic system billions of dollars.
But you can't replace that human ever again if you kill him. You can replace the problems and make up again.
Yeah, but there's only one.
It's like, should we kill the guy who made, you know, cars? Because they've killed cars and cost so much money and ruined environment. And
yeah, well, you know, see, I can see the economic, you know, viability of it, but. Because they're costing the system more than they're putting in.
They just wanted to have you click on the link, which I did, and maybe see their advertisers. If we execute murders, why don't we execute the people who write computer worms? Duh. It would probably be a better investment. First of all, there's no investment. You're not investing in killing anybody.
Yeah.
You may be saving an investment, but after they've written the worm, it's already done the damage.
That's true.
So then what's the deal? So sorry.
Well, except what they're trying to do is make it as a...
They're trying to scare the other writers.
Yeah, trying not to have any more come in.
Yeah.
Play.
Well,
but no, what's really cool is there's actually an Indian tribe in the northwest that their traditional law has been, if I were to kill you, my punishment would be is I take your place in your family.
Well, I'm going to start killing someone who has a really attractive wife and a nice family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that's, like, the coolest thing is, like, if you break it, fix it.
That might be, like, a way to actually upgrade. Like, kill your boss, take his job.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know.
But that's a little bit more traditional thing.
Hmm.
But I thought
that
isn't
that isn't it some sort of like Asian tradition off in some hidden village? Like, I think I remember seeing something like that. I don't know. Let's do the
well,
math.
They're more like a, you know, the family structure is just to who you accept. Hmm.
What do we get out of executing a murderer? Deterrence. A high estimate is that each execution deters about 10 murders.
I doubt it.
The highest estimate I've ever seen is 24 murders deterred per execution. But the closest thing to a consensus estimate in the econometric literature is about 8. That's 10 lives saved, with a value, again, a high-end estimate of about $10 million apiece. Basically, it keeps going into all this logistics, but I don't know. I think we tore apart the argument in the first two sentences. I don't know.
Well, except that you're actually preventing 8 murders. That's the whole thing, is if you actually really think that executing will prevent.
Yeah, that's if you believe that. And how do they come up with that? How do they measure these numbers? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, see, I think that's just really screwy. If, like, if you're so, if you hate or you are so angry enough to kill somebody, I don't think you're going to be like, you know what, if I kill them, I'm going to be killed.
Yeah, it's more like, that bastard's dead. And then they kill him and they're like, oh, crap, I might die. Because I might be executed. Yeah, but wait, it's America. I'll just go grab OJ's lawyer and be all
right. That's right.
So.
So I can pay $10 million because that's how much I'm going to make for the rest of my life.
Because we can go to courtroom and take it from real reality into ultra courtroom reality.
Oh, yeah.
Which has no bearing on real reality. But then we can spend a lot of time doing that. And maybe, just maybe, I'll get off.
But then I can be sued civilly. Right on.
Yeah.
That's the screwiest thing right there, that you could be sued twice. Yeah. They, yeah, you can be prosecuted twice. You can be prosecuted civilly and criminally.
I don't think they typically do that unless you did a charge of both.
Well, unless, well, that's the thing. Most criminal crimes can also be a civil one. But then there's a lot of civil things that aren't criminal.
You know, they've done so much to the system, and it's not like they just recently did this, but the system is designed so much, so there's so many damn loopholes and, you know, ways to if they want to screw you, they can screw you. And if, you know, if they don't want to screw you so much, they can make it so it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
It's on how well that you can frame that situation in reality, or out of reality.
Yeah.
Or hey, you frame it as it's a good thing. Or a bad thing.
Yeah. We actually have a lot of stuff to cover.
Oh, I know. We haven't gotten to my article yet.
I know. We'll let that be last, because that might... I don't want to... I fear the whole show will be covered the remaining time, because VR is very passionate about this article.
It's a great article.
It's so good. It's kid-tested and mother-approved. Okay, well, basically, after a stalled effort on Monday, which is back in mid-May, the European Council has approved controversial changes to the drafting directive, meaning that Europe is now likely to see widespread patenting of software programs. Boo. That's a very bad thing. It's like if you tried to patent cars, like, left and right, you know. That's why they have the big three. That's why they have, well, not the big three anymore, but, you know, GMC, and then, Ford and Chevy, right? And they...
Yeah.
Well, GMC...
Well, it's General Motors. Yeah, and then...
But they make both the same. There's a GMC Tahoe, and then there's like a Chevy Tahoe, right?
No.
Yeah, they make like the same cars.
Okay.
But they're like made by different makers. You know, and I think, you know, maybe that's how they got around, you know, having a... Because GMC has a lot of same cars as like a Chevy does.
Yeah, because I think they're the same manufacturer.
Yeah, but they're two companies. Maybe I'm dragging something on here, but I was thinking that when it comes to software patenting... You're going to have people saying, well, you can't do this because I have a patent. Well, what if somebody wants to improve it? And then they're going to go to war, and the only person that loses out is you, the consumer, because all they want to do is tie you into their product. The European Council on Wednesday voted through controversial changes to the European Union's Software Patents Directive that will pave the way for widespread patenting of software in Europe, according to a spokesman at the UK Department of Trade and Industry, which backed the changes. The vote removes many of the changes introduced last year by the European Parliament that would have limited the degree to which software programs could be patented.
Boo.
The text that was approved is very close to the original European Commission proposal. So the DTI spokesman, he said the DTI had not yet seen the final amendments. The directive will now be sent back to the European Parliament for another vote there in the autumn, and as the different bodies of the EU engage in a game of legislation ping-pong, while observers expect vociferous lobbying from open source and developer groups reversing the Council's vote will be difficult, according to James Held of the Foundation for the Free Information Infrastructure, the FFII, a not-for-profit organization that promotes the rights of technology entrepreneurs and developers. Isn't that nice? There's non-profit, and I think they specifically coined this phrase, not-for-profit.
No, actually, not-for-profit has been around for a while.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
So what's non-profit?
Non-profit is where you do not make a profit.
So,
and a not-for-profit is where you actually can make a profit, but that's not your intent.
Okay.
And I think it's when you make a profit, that's when you become, like, really taxed.
Okay.
Because a non-profit is taxed differently than a for-profit.
Okay, and now, moving along again. I thought this was absolutely a good idea for something. I read about this program, okay? This program, I think I found a use for it that was not originally intended. I think this is a very interesting way to send coded messages. Now, the program is called Echo Art, okay? And what it does is it works by intercepting ICMP echo request packets and consulting a pattern template to determine whether or not to respond to the traffic echo request. It then uses LibNet to inject responses back to the network as necessary. Now, what this does is as it sends responses, or it has the ability to receive responses, that, with a particular pattern, can make ASCII images.
Oh, wow.
So you could just appear to be pinging a network, but you could be actually sending them a text message.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it doesn't say that in here that it can do that. It just says, you can send these. Call it a stupid net trick.
Yeah, whoever thought of that had way too much free time on their hands.
Yeah.
And was a little too paranoid for their own good, but it's a great idea.
Well, they didn't even say what I said it could be used for.
Yeah.
EchoArt is a C program which responds to or drops ICMP echo request packets based on the predefined sequence. EchoArt can be used to return crude ASCII art in response to pings from a Cisco router. So you could send, my idea is that you could actually send, because you tell it what ASCII file you want it to send, you could send messages back and forth, and it could be a totally not known, nobody's going to know to, unless they hear this show or they know about this program, but for the most part.
And the ASCII key. You can actually put a key on it. You can encrypt that too.
What do you mean, put a key on it?
Yeah, you can put actually.
You're saying send some sort of encrypted message.
Uh-huh.
Within the ASCII message.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't think, that was the original intent, but, they have an example here.
Yeah, where you're actually using a code within a code within a code to send a code.
Yeah, and it's,
that's just as good as military encryption.
And it appears as just you sending ping requests, or ICMP echo requests, over the network. So that's Echo Art. You can grab that. Oh, where can you grab that at? You can definitely grab it, though. Just Google it. It'll come up. Echo Art, all one word. So I thought that was interesting. I don't have time really to play around to do that, but it's possible. There's an example of it right there. All right. And also, speaking of Cisco basically has gotten their source code stolen from them. A Russian security website, Security Lab, is reporting that the source code for Cisco Systems, Inc., main networking device operating system, was stolen on Thursday. It's back in mid-May. According to the report, criminal hackers broke into How about technically adept criminals broke into Cisco's corporate network and stole 800 megabytes of source code for the iOS 12.3 and 12.3T, which is an early development version containing features not found in the vanilla 12.3 version. In addition, a 2.5 megabyte sample was what is supposedly iOS code was released on Internet Chat Relay channel as proof of the alleged theft. This could be a big problem for Cisco.
Intellectual
property. Maybe actually it'll be a good thing because maybe the people will find bugs and it will get exploited, which that's the bad part, but then get improved possibly after that. But if the report is accurate, this represents a major security threat not for just Cisco users, but for the entire Internet, according to Del Olroy Group, a market research firm that specializes in the network and telecommunication industries, because Cisco owns 62% of the core router market.
Oh, yeah. I could see that being a problem.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah, now we have access to the source code for 62% of all routers.
Something like that.
That's kind of scary.
And, so moving along fast here, because I got a lot of good information, and I want to get it out. All right. Well, there's a protest over ID card pilot scheme. Campaigners in Glasgow have shown their opposition to the new national identity card pilot scheme. They showed their disapproval during a visit of Home Office Minister Des Brown, who was in the city to view the technology, which will be used. Volunteers are being invited to sign up to have their irises, fingerprints, and facial biometrics recorded as part of the UK Passport Service trial. Defy ID Glasgow is a new formed group, which opposes the project. Among the protesters to meet Mr. Brown as he arrived at the DVLA office in West Cambrook Street on Friday, which is earlier in May, was Patrick Harve, MSVP of the Green Party, just a spokesman. He believes the scheme, which is still being piloted with 10,000 volunteers across the UK, threatens civil liberties and is technologically unworkable with massive cost for the taxpayer.
Oh, yeah.
Marsh says the government ID card scheme will be an overpriced, unworkable project with few benefits for the taxpayer and far too many risks to civil liberties. Only by planning ahead and taking steps now to create a modern, secure means of confirming identity can we ensure that in the years to come we will be able to take on the increasingly sophisticated methods used by criminals and that UK citizens have a secure form of identity to use in everyday life and travel. Well, I know who I am when I travel. I don't need to tell anybody else that.
That whole sentence didn't make any sense because how can you, by determining who somebody is physically, can you do anything about, thwart, protect, counteract, or deal with what somebody can, is capable of, and will do? That's completely internal. That has nothing to do with their outside, with their biometrics. I think that whole statement is the biggest bunch of crap I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, well, you know, on top of it, it's kind of like that one movie that Tom Cruise was in where they actually would see projected crimes in the future and bust them before they happen.
Oh, yeah, a Minority Report.
Minority Report, you know, and that's just weird concept, but it's really...
But that's getting the chicken, you know, the egg, the chicken before the egg once again. It's like, we don't have that kind of technology to see what somebody's going to do, and so we need to know exactly who they are and not have a mistake about it. No, it's, yo, you can track just about anybody already that you need to.
You know, it drives me nuts if I had to go to jail and I didn't even commit the crime yet. I'd be so mad at that fact, you know?
You'd be like, yo, if you just give me another chance, I won't do it.
Yeah, or just let me commit the crime and then let me come here. I'll feel so much better because I know I'm being, you know, I would know why this is happening. I'd have something to possibly blame it on, you know?
Yeah, well, it'd be like, at least you'd have some closure, some justification. It's like, I didn't even do anything and I'm in jail.
Yeah, you can't, like, go in there and find God after you did something wrong because you didn't even do it yet, you know? The government is to introduce a compulsory national UK identity card scheme to help tackle organized crime and protect the identities of the British citizens using cutting-edge technology. The cards will link individuals' unique biometric data, such as iris scans, to a secure national database. Always a secure national database.
Oh, yeah.
The UK government published draft legislation last month to bring in a compulsory national identity card scheme. Well, nothing secure, okay? And if that kind of stuff can be accessed. Like, let's just say, you know, you need to have that. Use it at the store. Use it at here. Use it there. Use it there. You know, where does the security stop? And then you start losing security by spreading the service to so many mediums. And like, how do those people who have access to the computer at that level, you know, where you're doing the biometric data and stuff like that, and it ties back into a database or something like that. You know, this database can't just sit in a room. It's got to be, you know, out there in the public.
It's got to be over the line. It's got to be over the infrastructure.
Yeah, it's got to be a way to update this database, change it, modify it.
Yeah.
Who verifies this? Who does that? Who, you know, controls how that information gets sent? Who is the guy that's sitting at the driver's license terminal, you know, like at here and sending the fake driver's license? How about the guy that's sitting there saying that, you know, this is Slipmo, this is Iris, and this is everything else, but it's really not mine. It's somebody else's, you know? Who's that?
Or, you know, like when you're mistaken for dead. Oh, man, imagine how much work that would to be changed.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Or somebody could just hack in and just put... Like, oh, you're dead.
What was that movie? It was an older movie back in the 90s where these guys, they would create genetically supreme human beings, and they would go to school. They were very intelligent people and stuff like that. And this one guy wanted to be able to accomplish something. I forget what it was, but he needed to get into this area. And in order for him to get into this area, he actually worked with this other guy who was a genius and took over his... biometric data and stuff like that to act as him. He had a disability, but he was a genius, and he used his biometric data. That's how they checked him to pose as him and exist in his world and do these things, and they look similar and stuff like that.
Oh, that was Gattaca.
Gattaca, that's right.
There we go. That took a whole lot because how you described that was incredibly abstract. I'm thinking like... You know, some kind of like weird 80s movie.
Oh. Maybe there's zombies.
Actually kind of thinking like a horror, like mystery flick. And
all right. Well, here we actually, this is a short story. I'll just cover this really quickly. Don't like to rush things, but hey, got to get it out there. So it is found, I guess, that static electricity that can come from your phone or other things can ignite gas stations on fire.
Yeah, but. But what's kind of funny is it usually happens in cold, dry climates, and it's mostly women.
It's mostly women.
It's like 80-something percent that it happens to are women.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty funny. And normally they're the elderly or the, you know, old.
Maybe they put the men put the phones on the outside of their belts, and the women are putting it in their purses, and it's rubbing around. And
well, it's actually not... cell phones, it's just static electricity.
Hmm.
They even had it on Mythbusters a while back, and they tried to get a cell phone to ignite gasoline, and it just wouldn't.
Yeah, it could just be the static, and that's the nearest electronic thing to them, and they blamed it on that.
But it's actually, like, if you're...
They said in the article it is static, it's not the phone. So.
Yeah, it's... All you have to do to thwart it is to touch the vehicle every time you get in and out. And if you don't get back in your vehicle... When you're feeling gas, you don't even have to worry about it. It's that you put the pump in, get in your vehicle, you get out, and if you don't touch the vehicle, when you pull the nozzle out of the car, there's a spark.
Yeah.
At where all the gas fumes are.
All right. Okay. Well, it's kind of funny. This is an article here that talks about how IBM is just kind of doing an all-out barrage of Linux, and it kind of is because they don't like Microsoft so much, and I think they're just getting back a little bit at them.
I think so.
It's
about time.
Article goes on and says, it says Linux represents the biggest problem and threat to Microsoft's ever faced. No wonder IBM is spending billions to promote it. How is it that for 8 months, a team held up by a dozen IBM consultants has been tolling in the data centers and computer rooms of Munich City government free of charge, having goaded, that's what it says, having goaded Munich into embracing open source software, IBM is helping it plan in migrating 14,000 computers off Microsoft Windows and onto operating systems such as Linux. The operating system known as Linux. Never mind the IBM doesn't sell Linux, which is distributed free, and never mind that Munich officials say they're not committed to buying IBM hardware or consulting services despite IBM's free help. Through IBM, did not, though IBM did not invent Linux, does not distribute it or earns near a penny on it. The giant in 2003 sales of $89 billion is spending billions in crusade to make Linux the world's most popular operating system. All told, more than 12,000 IBMers today devote at least part of their time to Linux. IBM has invested millions in two lead Linux distributors, Red Hat and SUSE. It has spent millions more to co-found and fund the nonprofit organization that oversees Linux development. In developing nations, IBM has opened 20 Linux training centers where it schmoozes government ministries and explains how Linux can create jobs for the young. To hear IBM's tell it all, this effort is a matter of giving more choices to customers. Tired of the Microsoft monopoly, no one wants to be monopolized and controlled. Consumers have been dominated by a single vendor. Linux gives you a chance to unlock that, says James Stallings, general manager of IBM's Linux business. We've got more. We've got 50 more details like Munich going right now, but IBM has broader agenda undermining Bill Gates' company. Here lies in the next big battle in tech, pitting two erstwhile allies against each other in a fight to rule the computer industry in the years ahead as big corporate customers seek to lash together worldwide networks and imbue them with more online commerce. A new $21 billion market for web link software has emerged.
Well, that's true. Well, that's the only way that IBM is going to survive, is if they keep that market open, really.
Well, they have a lot of stuff going for them, but yeah, that's really going to boost them to do that. So.
Yeah, because then they also get consulting and all, you know, other things and great stuff.
So, and also, Microsoft has agreed to pay Norway's Opera Software, which is basically the Opera browser, $12.75 million to head off a threatened lawsuit over code that made some web pages on MSN look bad in certain versions of Opera's web browser. Basically, Opera disclosed the payment last week in Terse press release that omitted other details, including the name of the settling party and the nature of the dispute. But a source indicated that the payment came from Microsoft in order to close the books on a clash of obscure interoperability problems. On at least three separate occasions, Opera has accused Microsoft of deliberately breaking interoperability between its MSN portal and the various versions of the Opera browser, charges that the software giant has repeatedly denied. So you're not really supposed to know who the payment came from, but it's a good indication it came from Microsoft.
Yay.
And let's see.
But that's kind of a pittance to what they do on a regular basis.
Yeah. I got another article here about Microsoft bashing Linux. No biggie. We've heard all their quals before. And Oracle is basically doing like many people are doing. Oracle will finish switching its 9,000-person in-house programming staff to Linux by the end of 2004, the database powerhouse said. By the end of the year, Linux is our core platform, and Oracle is switching because Linux systems are less expensive and faster. It's not often that Oracle makes such a change. The last time they did so was in the early 90s, moving from Digital Equipment VMS to Sun Solaris. Oracle isn't alone in embracing the open source movement. Dell is switching internal servers to Linux, while Novell is dropping Windows in favor of its own Linux desktop software for PCs.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, it sounds like Microsoft is definitely losing a foothold.
Yeah. And they're not liking it. Actually, that one article where they're bashing Linux and saying in the Asia market to not adopt the Linux, it's actually a person that used to work for Red Hat. So he sold out to the Microsoft man, and is bashing Linux and making some contradictions in the process. All right. Well, I know that VR is very excited about this article. And I found it, but I let VR take a look at it because I knew he'd be interested. And he has.
This is good stuff.
He has taken quite a liking to it. So I'm going to let VR take it away.
All right. It was really interesting that this guy is promoting biodiesel. You know, that it lays down the argument that most of the problems that we're having in the world today are coming from petroleum producing countries. That's where most of the terrorists are. They recruit and blah, blah, blah. So what's the best way to get somebody to not do something you want? You don't do what they want. So to get rid of, to essentially de-promote terrorism, it would be much better off if we used biodiesel instead of petroleum. This stuff is absolutely amazing. It is made from natural oil. And the neatest thing is that it could be... All of the country's need for petroleum could be satisfied in 11,000 square miles. It's roughly 9% of the area of the Sonoran Desert in Arizona. But at the same time, if you convert that 9,000 square miles of Sonoran Desert into their algae-producing fields, then you're destroying like 10% of an ecosystem. Not sure, you know, it's like giving one for another. And which would actually produce 140.8 billion gallons of biodiesel. It's an amazing amount. And let's see, what is it? So algae turns into biodiesel. What is left over, or the sludge that's left over, makes an ideal fertilizer. It's higher in nitrogen, phosphorus. Such algae farms could also be used in waste streams from agriculture to aid the algae's growth, because it'll eat it all up. Let's see. And what's absolutely amazing is it gets down to...
How much are we getting paid for this endorsement here?
You know what? I just want them to send me a diesel car, and the instant biodiesel is available. I will drive to it and buy it. Because I've been a big hydrogen fan for years. I've been like...
Makes your head kind of feel funny, doesn't it?
No, that's helium.
I'm just joking.
You know, I've been like spewing hydrogen, like, this is the greatest thing for the planet and the earth and economics and, you know, the human existence and the universe all wrapped up into one. But this biodiesel, this is amazing, because, you know, of that 11,000 acres that's needed to do it, it costs, you know, $60,000 per acre to make it work. But that would work out to roughly $169 billion in return. So it's actually the profit is just massive on that. Let's see. And if we want to go into, it's kind of interesting that hydrogen has to be stored at very high pressures to make up for its low energy density, because really, you know, it's just a hydrogen atom that's sitting there, and once it gets a spark, it bonds with two of them bond with an oxygen, and it makes water. But diesel fuel has a very high energy density. And so, well, it's got a whole lot of energy potential that's, you know, collapsed, you know, because it's actually in a molecule. It actually takes up less space than all these free-roaming hydrogens. And so, let's see, diesel fuel has an energy density of 1,058 BTUs per cubic foot. Biodiesel has an energy density of 950 BTUs per cubic foot, and hydrogen stored at 3,626 PSI, that's 25 times atmospheric pressure, only has an energy density of 68 BTUs per cubic foot. You know, that's amazing. You know, how much more, you know, energy density that the stuff has. Now, if you actually get to, let's say, hydrogen fuel, could be produced by electrolyzing water or electrolysis, and the system is about 60% efficient. And so the amount of energy recovered in the hydrogen is produced is equivalent to 0.6 units. And the hydrogen then needs to be compressed at high pressure for storage in the fuel tanks. Due to its low energy density, the hydrogen then has to be stored at high pressure so the vehicle can actually have a reasonable range. So compressing the hydrogen it takes energy, but for the moment, we'll ignore this energy cost, as well as the cost of transporting the hydrogen. Likewise, we will ignore the cost of transporting biodiesel. And the transporting of biodiesel would be more efficient since hydrogen needs to be stored and shipped in high pressure and stable metal containers, which are very heavy. And whereas biodiesel can be shipped in the same fuel trucks used today. And the mass of the fuel tankers for transporting hydrogen is greater a percentage of the energy, is a greater percentage of the energy yield than for biodiesel. So hydrogen can be produced with an energy balance of a 0.6 to 1, or 6 units produced for every for the energy input, which is about 60%. So the current generation of fuel cells is 50 to 60% efficiency.
I see.
Yes. And so assuming that this 60% efficiency that reduces the overall energy yield from 0.6 to 1 down to 0.36 to 1, that means for each unit of energy that goes into producing the fuel of hydrogen, 0.36 units of energy gets used for moving a vehicle. So the limited range of hydrogen-powered vehicles makes them comparable to electric vehicles. Now the energy balance, however, completely different. While a hydrogen vehicle would be using electricity to electrolyze water to get hydrogen for fuel, an electric vehicle uses electricity to charge batteries. Battery charging system is around 90% efficiency compared to the 60% efficiency of electrolysis. Using the charged batteries to propel a car has an efficiency of in the upper 90s, 90 percentile range.
Pierre?
Yes.
What encompassed the main point here?
Well, anyway, I'll just get one last thing. The soybeans, using soybeans and turning the soy into biodiesel, we will get back 3.2 units of energy. That is actually an increase of energy by 320%. So for pretty much every other energy resource, that is, you actually get back more energy than you put into it.
Well, that's what we need. That's cold fusion right there.
And
in this sense, the...
And it will completely eliminate our need for...
fossil fuels?
Yeah, because then we don't have to rely on OPEC and drill in the, in any reserves or whatnot, because you can actually create your own algae field and produce biodiesel.
So me and you
and in the process of growing the algae and harvesting it and the fertilizer which comes from it produces alcohol, which would then actually add to...
Did you write this article? Did you write this article?
Which then would actually, you could use that alcohol to create the energy in order to refine it into biodiesel.
I think if me and you both took off our shoes, we might be able to power a flashlight for 30 seconds with the bio, the algae and the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, mine might be a minute or two.
All right. Okay, well... I was smart to put that at the end of the show.
Which that's just an amazing thing because I have been a big hydrogen electric fuel guy for so long.
Electric fuel?
Electric car.
Power?
Yeah, whatever. Alternative fuel. Here comes this thing which just blows everything out of the water. By efficiency, infrastructure-wise, you could do like diesel hybrid cars, which then would boost the efficiency up even more.
Do they actually have any testing, though, that they've really got this working?
Well, it can work already on a standard diesel engine, so it doesn't really matter. Because as long as it can be used and drives the car, that's great.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up the May 30 edition of the In-N-Out Show. Sorry for the website being down. It's going to be back up. It's not going to be going down. And anything else to close there?
Go biodiesel.
Yeah, go biodiesel.
I'm really thinking about buying a diesel now.
I need to update the email address on the website because that's now going to be incorrect and a few other things. I'm still looking to do it. I'm still looking to revamping the site, how it looks, and make it a little bit more jazzier, maybe put some pictures of me in VR and in this crazy place that we operate out of here, and up on the site, and give some personality to it. And one last thing to add is I picked up from Rusty. We've talked about him with him actually on previous shows. A parabolic 24 dB of gain grid antenna here, which is great because I talked with Rusty, and I guess I looked at the stats here, but it didn't tell me this one bit of information that Rusty told me, that if we, you know, we're sitting off a mountaintop and we had some clear projection line of sight, then I could broadcast my wireless signal about 90 miles with this antenna.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so we're probably going to try to do this. I need to get actually a different card. I need to get a D-marker, Sineo card that actually has...
That'd be fun to, like, test and try out.
Well, this is what we want to do, is that with a D-mark card, it's the output for transmit's 300 milliwatts. So that's a third of a watt. The Sineo can go up to, if you change the transmit power, up to 249 milliwatts. And I need to pick up one of those cards. I've got a nice war driving card in Orinoco, but I need to get one with some more transmit power. And we're thinking of doing here in Arizona, me sitting on Camelback Mountain, Rusty sitting on South Mountain, and us trying to send data back and forth to each other with these antennas and try to find each other with a telescope. And
well, heck, you could go all the way out to like Four Peaks.
Well, yeah, but I'd like to test it in a shorter range before I try the larger range. And do that. So that's really cool. He picked those up at a way discounted price, and I jumped on that as soon as I could. So this thing's about 3 feet, a little over 3 feet wide, and it's just sitting here in my room, and it's a fun geek thing to have.
And when he puts some power to it, he can microwave a hamburger in no time.
Yeah. If we put a few watts through there, we can actually use it as a microwave. Wouldn't that be interesting? All right. Well, this is your host, Slip Mode, signing out with another edition of In the Now. And trusty sidekick, as usual,
Biodiesel Rules.
That's his new name, Biodiesel Rules.
No, PR out.
All right. We'll see everyone in 2 weeks. See you then.